Good morning, everyone. We've got about a minute left before we begin, but I'm going to ask a big favor of you before we begin, and that is my parents still don't really understand what I do for my living. And I've never taken a picture from stage before, so I'm going to take a little panorama shot right now to share with my parents. So we're going to do that right now. All right, hold the phone steady. All right, there's one. Yeah. Whoops, hold on, my phone lost me. Yeah, well, that was a good idea to wave. We'll try again here, okay. All right, wave at Mom and Dad. We're starting with this side of the room. Oh, the phone's having problems because of the spotlight. We're just going to take multiple pictures and stitch them later. All right. Well, the panorama doesn't like the big spotlight in my face. It's throwing it off. All right, so this side of the room. One. There we go. Oops, and without the flash. I'm going to figure this out eventually. Now you know I'm serious. I've never done this from stage. Okay, there's one. All these variables. Who would have thought? Okay, now the center. Focus and shoot. All right. Yeah. All right, this side of the room. All right, and the corner here. One, two, three. Right on. Thank you. All right. I appreciate your help. I also really appreciate the fact that we've got a full room of people. Last night when I checked the MySPC site, there were 896 people registered for this session. And I bet you absolutely none of you have an idea of what this session's about, because the abstract was purposefully as vague as it possibly could be. So I really appreciate either your faith or your insanity or whatever it might be that brought you here today. So before we begin, even before I do an intro, I want to talk about what this session is about so that those of you who really did come going, what in the world is this about, I can tell you now, and then you can decide whether it's right for you. And if it's not, go ahead and leave. I certainly am not going to take it personally. But I think it's really going to be a great session. The goal of this session is to demystify a number of topics that tend to be problematic for organizations and for individuals implementing SharePoint on-prem and in the cloud, although this session is very heavily on-prem. To cover topics that often don't get the kind of coverage and attention and love they need at an event like this, because they may not take an hour and 15 minutes to talk about, and yet they're very, very, very important. So we're going to look at under-discussed, under-documented, misdocumented, misunderstood, underutilized features that that need some attention in our implementations of SharePoint. The topics, I've got this big collection of slides that I use for these sessions, and I pick them out based on what I know is happening elsewhere in the event. I tweak it in real time as well, so that we can cover as much as possible. These are the things I believe we're going to have time to cover in this session, and then we'll talk about some additional things on top of that. I want to make sure we talk about some of the issues that impact how we interact with other teams in our organizations, and the dependencies that SharePoint has on technologies like Active Directory. And of course, SQL as well. We're also going to look at some challenges and questions people commonly have related to administrative delegation, to managing access and security, and to the new sharing model in SharePoint 2013 and in Office 365. So when I talk to people about this session face-to-face, I say it's a technical grab bag. It's a lot of little topics that I think are important, misunderstood, not used enough in organizations, and we'll pound those out and cover as much as we can. Then we hopefully will have some time to throw in some extra topics that I have in my head, and we'll hopefully have some time for some Q&A as well. So that's the goal, if that doesn't sound good to you. It's definitely it's not a business level talk. This is more of a technical talk for sure. It's charted at a 201, but you'll see that we sort of dive in and out of levels of depth. It's very practical technical information. So that's that. And the other announcement I want to make at the beginning of the session is something I tweeted out earlier today. Many of you might have seen it, and that is that I'm a co-founder of IT Unity, which is a new online content and community resource that will be going live in a couple of weeks. The goal with this site is to really be the center of conversation about how businesses solve problems with technology. There are a lot of awesome resources out there on the internet. There are a lot of great experts. We have, I think, the best community in technology, a very vibrant, excited, passionate community. We've got ISVs with quality solutions and partners with great services, and all of them are all over the place. And what we hope to do is help connect the dots and create structure and connection that creates value, so that when you as a business are trying to solve problems, you not only can learn A to Z what it takes to plan, implement, support, deploy, manage, extend a particular solution, but also What other organizations have done, what's worked, what hasn't, what's successful, what's failed, what's hard, what really requires third-party extensions, so that we can create some connection and some value between the really wonderful resources that are out there. And so it's really about coming together to win. And as I thought about this morning, I thought I really wanted, and this literally was something I thought about in the shower this morning, I want to really enforce this, this message of coming together and winning. And let me go back a slide real quick here. Because my personal view of community is very much along the lines of what President Clinton said in his keynote, and that is the world is a positive-sum game. It's not a zero-sum game. I live my life by that rule. And what that means, really, in the case of a community, is when you bring people together, and different people have different strengths and different weaknesses and different needs and different solutions, you're able to create incredible value in those connections and raise all boats. Now, I'm going to give you a really dorky story that illustrates that example. I hate to gamble. I hate to lose my money. I've got a mortgage to pay. It really stresses me out to put money. I've never put money down on a blackjack table. I've only rarely put a quarter or a dollar in slots. It just stresses me out. But I'm working with this great team of people at IT Unity. One of them is named Jackie, and she's one of the luckiest people I know. She walks up to a blackjack table as on the first night we're here, one hand, puts down 200 bucks, becomes 400. I'm like, wow, that's really amazing. That's so cool. It's like, oh, I want to support her. So it's like, so the three of us who were here from the team at that time, each gave her 50 bucks. And you know, that was okay with me because it wasn't going to be me losing my money. I just, right there, it was me spending it on her, right? And that's cool because she enjoys it, she has fun, and she's good and lucky at it. Then I went back up to my room to work on my slides, and within a half an hour, I got a text from Jackie saying, we just won $4,000. In slots. I mean, I was like, that is amazing. You put me, who doesn't like to gamble but who likes to support my friends, together with someone who likes to gamble, and all of a sudden, it's 4,000 bucks split three ways. I was like, this is really, really cool. I can gamble by proxy a lot. And because she managed to win this for us, I was like, I want to share this, some of my part of my winnings as well. And so in the shower this morning, I was like, what better way to do that than to share with people who are here in the room now, particularly because IT Unity is doing an Xbox giveaway down on the expo floor. Some of you may have even entered that game, and you have to be present to win, and you're not. So I want to make sure that everyone here has a chance to win as well. So what I'm going to do personally is I'm going to give away either an Xbox or a Surface 2, whichever the winner chooses. And a separate winner, I'm going to give $500 to the charity of their choice, because IT Unity really believes in giving back, and one of our core founding values is that a portion of our gross revenues are going to go to charity. So I want to do that as well in this giveaway. And so what I want to do is give you three ways to enter this contest. The site is not live yet with content, but it's live where you can go grab your username, where you can grab what's called your handle. So you can go and do that. That's one way. The second way is to tweet the message that's on the screen or simply retweet my tweet that I did just before we started. Or the third is to email me. And as long as you do one of those three things today, we're just going to collect all those bits of information, pick out two random winners, and we'll contact those winners. If you register on our site or if you tweet, we will notify you when the site goes live. If you want to enter but don't want to be notified when the site goes live, email me and just tell me, and we'll make sure you're not added to that list. But all we're going to do is notify you when the site goes live. But it's really about this demonstration. When you come together, you all win. I truly believe that. I think we've got a room full of amazing people with extraordinary experiences. Many of us are already sharing our experiences with the community, and I hope that IT Unity is going to be able to be there to amplify those messages and connect people to create new value. So that was that's what I was tweeting about this morning. I wanted to cover that as well. So with that, let's dive into the session. My name is Dan Holm. Many of you know who I am, so just really briefly, I'm an MVP currently in Office 365. Prior to that, I'd been an MVP in SharePoint for 7 years and Active Directory for one or two. And I spend my days traveling the world, but I'm called Maui home. So I'm lucky enough to be able to live in a really beautiful place on the planet. Very small SharePoint community, so if ever you're there, give me a shout. And if I'm there, we'll share a pint. As a consultant, I've spent 20 years in major Fortune caliber organizations, including NBC. And as many of you know, I spent the last, if I can get the slide to advance. We're having low battery, maybe. I spent the last 5 weeks in Sochi, Russia, supporting NBC for the broadcast of the Winter Olympic Games. Got back last week, had 72 hours to do laundry, and came here. And I had to get here quickly because I was a co-owner of the executive track. So I helped Laura Winkelbach and Jess Brown from Yammer put together the content for our executive track, which we're very excited to offer for the first time and are really looking forward to people's feedback on so we can improve the offerings and the support we give to business decision makers at future events. I've also done a lot of writing over my life, including the SharePoint 2010 training kit. And one of the reasons why I didn't do a book for SharePoint 2013 is I knew we had to have a new model for getting content out quickly and keeping it up to date as Microsoft is adding new features every day. And that is to use an online resource such as IT Unity, which is one of the reasons that we're creating that, is to create relevant and current content. So that's who I am. Enough about that. Let's dive into our technical grab bag called SharePoint 2013 Demystified. Now, the first topic we're going to look at is the interdependencies between SharePoint and Active Directory. Some little things, some bigger things, again, very practical. And I am going to move very quickly through these topics. I'm already talking quickly, and I apologize if I'm moving too fast. But remember, this is recorded. You will get the slides. They are either just now or very shortly will be on my SPC. And I will also give you a URL where you can download the slides and the scripts. There's one or two little scripts I'm going to show you that I will give you as well. So, starting with Active Directory here, a couple of small topics. When you're working in Active Directory, or when you're working with SharePoint, you're relying on the infrastructure of your domain to manage the machines, and most of us are using Windows authentication to authenticate our users as well. So there's definitely some interdependencies here, and I want to talk about a couple of things we can do with Active Directory to make our lives managing SharePoint more straightforward. The first is what's called the installation blocker. There's actually a registry entry that if it is on a server, the SharePoint installation setup.exe will not run. It says installation is blocked. So it prevents SharePoint from being installed on a machine. Microsoft added that back in the days of WSS v3 and SharePoint 2007 as a way of preventing the chaos, sort of everyone has a SharePoint server under their desk challenge that people were facing at the time. So there's this registry setting that blocks installation. That registry setting can be baked into your images, or you can use an Active Directory technology called Group Policy Preferences to push it out into your environment. Now, because we don't have time to have a half-hour class about group policy, if you're not familiar with group policy, the nutshell is you can define a setting centrally in Active Directory and scope it out to any machines in your environment. So what we're going to do is we're going to create a setting that blocks installation of SharePoint. We're going to deploy it to the entire domain as sort of the default. And then in our SharePoint server OU, we will unblock the installation so that if a server is put into the SharePoint OU, it then gets the right setting and can install SharePoint. And that just gives us a really simple baseline for how we manage installation in SharePoint. So let's jump over to our domain. Let me log on. And I'm going to be giving you these solutions in the forms of scripts rather than, again, taking 10 minutes to step you through doing group policy. So I'm just going to give you scripts that do them. And we'll go ahead and run the script, and then we'll look at the script. And then the first script you're going to get is a very simple one that you might do manually, which is simply a script that creates the correct OUs. This is a fresh domain here. You'll notice very standard organizational units over on the left. This script simply creates OUs that then the other scripts assume are there. So that's run. Let's refresh our domain. And you'll notice now there is a servers OU, and within that there is a SharePoint OU. So it's just simply creating those two OUs, and within the SharePoint OU, that's where we'll eventually deploy our servers. Then we're going to run the second script, which creates the SharePoint blocker GPOs. Now, again, this goes through a couple of steps that would take 20 minutes to describe manually. The result is it creates these things called group policy objects. And group policy objects, again, are containers for settings. So there is a group policy object that's created called, oh, I have to refresh again. And let me scope this out as well here. So the script created two group policy objects. It created the group policy object called SharePoint installation block That's the one that's blocking installation for the whole domain. And then it created one called SharePoint Installation Enable that's linked to that SharePoint OU that we created. So again, the default is for the whole domain, you can't install SharePoint, but within this one OU, you can. Now, if we look inside those GPOs, those group policy objects, and for those of you who do know group policy, you'll see exactly what's happening. What that script does is it creates two registry settings. Actually, that's going to be too long to zoom in on, so let's just keep it this way. It creates two registry settings called disable install set to one. And there's two because there's one setting for SharePoint 2010 and one setting for SharePoint 2013. So it's poking two registry entries in, it's specifying the configuration of two registry entries called disable install, one for in a key that's for 2010 and one that's in a key for 2013. Again, these two settings are part of a group policy object scoped to the whole domain. Now, if anyone tries to install SharePoint anywhere in the domain, it is going to be blocked. Now, the other GPO, the other group policy object, is linked to the server's OU, and that simply has the same two registry entries, but instead of being in policy settings that poke the value one into the setting, these are settings that delete that registry key. You'll notice the little red X in the icon. So the scripts do everything you need. The only thing you would need to modify in the scripts are the OU names for your domain if you're not using the same ones I'm using. And so when you get the scripts, you can open them up in Notepad, make those changes, deploy them, and you'll have the solution. So let's take a real quick look at the scripts. See, the key one is this one, the create blocker. You'll see I've got it very heavily commented. And if we zoom in, all of the variables you would need to set are at the very beginning. Specifically, the domain, I'm having trouble there with my zoom, the domain name, and then the OU of the 2013 servers and the 2010 servers, and it assumes that you might have separate OUs for those two categories of servers, and then down at the bottom, the friendly names for the group policies. Those are the only things you would ever need to change, because everything else is driven by Microsoft and the way group policy works and the way the registry works. So if you just simply change those settings to match your environment, it will allow you to deploy those. Now, you do have to have appropriate rights in Active Directory, which by default are domain administrators. But your domain administrators could delegate that to a lower level administrator as well. So that's the installation blocker. Again, the goal is to manage where SharePoint is being installed, to support your governance by saying in this part of our Active Directory, we'll allow SharePoint to run on these machines, but the rest we won't. And of course, you might want to do the exact same thing in your development OU, where in development VMs or development workstations, you enable SharePoint to be installed. Now, the next thing we can do in Active Directory to support our governance and management of SharePoint is what's called the farm installation marker. Now, what this does is it creates a spot in Active Directory where any time a SharePoint farm is installed, it registers itself so that in the future, you can easily identify how many farms are in your environment. So let's take a look at how that works. Now, all of these things I'm showing, are heavily documented on the net. They're heavily documented on TechNet. So I'm not going into too many of the details, but I just want to make sure you can do them easily and understand what they're doing. So this third script is going to create the AD marker container, and I'm going to let it run, and then we will show you the result. So we just ran that script, and what it does is in Active Directory, in your domain, in the system container, so this is kind of like an OU, but it's called a container, it creates another container called Microsoft SharePoint Products. So that the script basically creates that container. It has to have that name. It has to be in that location. So those are all defaults. The only thing you have to change in the script is the name of your domain. It creates that container, and by default, when you run psconfig to join a server to a new farm or to create a new farm from a server, that server registers itself. It automatically looks in Active Directory for this container with this name in this location, and it registers itself. So then you know how many farms you've got installed. So let's jump to let's jump to another VM. This one is the same domain, just a little bit forward in time, where we already have installed the SharePoint farm. And if we look at that SharePoint products container in our system container, we see there's now this little object. This object is called a service connection point object, and this registers the domain. It has attributes that tell you information about the farm. And there are PowerShell scripts on TechNet that you can use to say, what farms do I have? And those PowerShell scripts simply connect to Active Directory and enumerate the service connection point objects in that container. So it's a really great, simple way. One, you only have to do it one time in your whole enterprise, in your whole domain, to create these management capabilities that say, first, I don't want just anyone to install SharePoint. I want to have some control over who gets SharePoint. And secondly, when someone does install SharePoint, I want to know where SharePoint is being installed. That can improve your licensing compliance. It can improve all kinds of things. Now, normally in this session, I'm going to wait for questions till the end, but someone has a burning question here, so let me grab that. Yep, great question. So his question is, once you put the blocker in place, does it do anything to existing farms? And the answer is no. This blocker is a real simple little thing that the setup.exe looks for and won't run if it sees it. So it won't change existing farms. It simply manages farms moving forward. Sure. So those are a couple of small things we can do in Active Directory to make our lives easier. More importantly, we need to make sure that we are managing service accounts associated with SharePoint with a least privilege model. Now, many of you have installed SharePoint before. The guidance to service accounts hasn't changed really much at all since SharePoint 2010, which itself hadn't changed much since 2007. So this is not necessarily huge news or rocket science, but I want to move through it very quickly. There's a lot of details on TechNet. Todd Clint has also done a great job of documenting this on his blog. And in the slide deck, there are a lot of details. So I'm going to skip through this real quickly, and you'll be able to go into the slide deck and get the details. But there's a couple of points I want to make about things that are underdocumented, misunderstood, et cetera. So there's a whole set of accounts you need to create for both the services and the human beings who are administering those services in SharePoint. This is a single slide that lists many of them. And then there are slides that go into the details of each one. So for example, you need a service account for SQL if you're starting a new SQL instance for SharePoint. You need an administrative account for SQL. If you're doing least privilege of SQL, you should have the agent running as a separate account. And those are basically standard Windows accounts, nothing too crazy about them. And TechNet has details about what you can do to really pimp up, so to speak, the security of SQL. And then on the SharePoint side, you also need some accounts. And this is one I want to spend a quick couple of moments on, and that is the SP admin account, which is often called the SharePoint setup user account in Microsoft documentation. I like to call it the SharePoint administrator and setup user account. And this is an account that many of us have or have heard about but have not necessarily gone all the way with. This account is used by a service administrator, a human being, to perform bit-level changes, specifically to install SharePoint and to install service packs, cumulative updates, language packs, those kinds of things. So it's used to do bit-level changes to the servers, to add and remove servers to the farm, to update them. And the reason this account, and one of the key points about this account, is that it should not be it should be a unique generic administrative account that is not your administrative account. In other words, if I'm going to install SharePoint, I should not log on as Dan, nor should I log on as Dan_admin to set up SharePoint. And the reason is, when you do bit-level changes, you're doing things to the registry, to the file system, and to other objects, and your account gets tattooed as the owner of some of those things. So if you were to look at some ACLs and some security descriptors within the registry and the file system, you would actually see Dan_admin in there, which isn't necessarily bad, except that when Dan gets promoted or leaves the organization, you now have these challenges where if you delete Dan's account in Active Directory, you get account unknown stuff all over the place, which tends to freak out your auditors. And it just isn't clean. It's not technically a huge problem, but it's just not clean, and it's easy to solve. And that is simply that you create a generic account that is used by administrators when they're performing bit-level changes. What it represents in concept is that the enterprise owns the service, not Dan. So it's really saying, you know, my company owns this SharePoint implementation, and then that's the account I'm logging on as. Same thing is true for all services. They all should be treated this way. Now, that account can be locked down and in many cases even disabled when it's not being used to perform bit-level changes. So, you know, it doesn't have to be an account that's used regularly. In fact, it shouldn't be. It can be locked down until it's needed. And as soon as you're finished performing the bit-level changes and SharePoint is actually installed, that's when, as SP admin, you go to the farm administrators group and add Dan_admin into the farm administrators group. And from that point forward, I use my own account to configure and manage SharePoint, but I don't own the bits. So it's a very subtle difference from a concept perspective. It makes a difference from a cleanliness perspective. It can impact audits. So, and it's easy to do right. So this is sort of the guidance for that account. Now that account is going to need to be, in order to do what it needs to do, a domain user account that's an administrator on each server that will become a SharePoint server in the farm. It needs to have the correct SQL privileges, which as many of you know, allow that account to create the farm configuration database and then delegate that to the farm service account. So it has two privileges that enable that. And then if you're going to use PowerShell to do some of the bit-level changes in SharePoint, you're going to need to make sure that account has been given PowerShell access as well with the add SP shell admin commandlet. And the details, again, on all those things are in TechNet, but as long as you've got this as a checklist, you're going to be able to do it right. So that's the SP admin account. Then you've got SP farm, which is your farm service. Again, this is something we all have at some level or another. It's used for all the highly privileged services and components of SharePoint, including the timer service and the central administration application pool and the STS service. This is a domain user account, and SharePoint assigns permissions automatically. So this is a very easy standard account. The main thing to know is that this account should only be used as SP Farm. A human being should really never, ever log on as SP Farm. There was a thread of tweets recently where a consultant was saying, I just went into a client and SharePoint was broken and I asked them to log on and they logged on as SP Farm and I knew the job was over and I just left. It was going to be a disaster. This is meant to be a service account. The only time it needs to be given permissions directly is when you're provisioning the user profile synchronization service. At that moment, it needs to be in the administrator's group of the server in the farm that's running the UPS service so that the farm account can stop and start that service. So for that one moment in time, you add it into the local administrator's group, you provision the user profile synchronization service so it can be configured, and then you take the account out of the local administrator's group, and if you don't, you'll get warnings in your health analysis. Otherwise, it does everything it needs. It gets all the permissions it needs. The next couple of accounts are simply identities for application pools. And we'll talk more about this in more detail in a minute, but conceptually, you're going to have service applications and you're going to have web applications, user-facing, and you're going to want to have them in separate application pools. And when you have separate application pools, it's a very good idea to have separate identities so that you can manage security more effectively. So you have an account for service apps, an account for web apps. Keeping it simple, we'll just assume you have two right now. We'll get into more detail in a minute. Those are then used as you create your first web application and as you create your first service applications, you assign those. And SharePoint does a very good job of assigning those the permissions they need. So as long as you have the accounts, SharePoint will do the right things with them. Now we'll go into more detail on application pools in just a minute. You're also then going to need an account for the crawling of content, SP_crawl, for example. And this is your search default content access account. So when you configure search, you say this is the default crawler. The default crawler is a domain user account, and it requires read permission to all indexed content. Now, after you assign the crawler and create a new web application, SharePoint automatically gives the crawler full read policy to that web application. So as soon as you've defined the crawl account, SharePoint does the right things moving forward. But if you have created web applications before you create the crawler, you have to go back to those web applications and give the crawler full read access to those content sources. So you need at least one of these accounts, and you want to make sure that you're not using this account for anything else, because it's going to have very broad access to content in your environment, basically anything that's being indexed. And so you don't want to use it for any other sort of purpose. You don't want to give it any more permission than it needs because it's going to have very, very broad access. And then as you add additional content sources, you might choose to use different accounts. So for example, if you're going to crawl a file share or you're going to crawl some Exchange resources, you might very well say, I'm going to have a separate crawler to do that. I want a separate identity to separate the create security isolation. And so as you move into additional sources, you might choose or you might even need to create additional content access accounts. Similarly, you're going to need an account if you are synchronizing Active Directory into your user profile database. So of course, SharePoint has the ability to take attributes of users like their manager and their job title and their phone numbers and pull those in to the user profile. You can do that as an import one time and sort of manually keep it up to date, or you can synchronize it, meaning every time there's a change in Active Directory, those changes are eventually brought into the user profile service. Now, if you're going to do that, the user profile synchronization, you're going to need a service account to access Active Directory. It's, again, a domain user account, but it needs a delegation that is very simple but freaks your Active Directory team out. The permission this account needs is called replicating directory changes. And it's very much like saying, I'm going to give this account read permission or write permission. It's just called replicating directory changes. And you have to delegate it at the domain. So effectively, what you have to do, let's go back to our domain here. Is the domain administrator has to right-click on the domain, go to delegate control, pick the user synchronization account, and delegate it the permission for replicating directory changes, which is right there. So that's about the process, less than 30 seconds to do. But because you're giving a permission that sounds strange and sounds powerful at the domain level, your Active Directory team will completely freak out in many cases. And it becomes this little political war. So what I want to do is I want to tell you what this is really doing in a way that hopefully you can explain it to your AD team. And if your AD team has any questions about them, have them call me, because many of them will remember me from their training. And I'll just say, listen to them. Your SharePoint team is telling you the truth. So what this does is it simply gives the account a more efficient permission than it already has. Every user in Active Directory already has very broad read permission to every other user's attributes. So I can look at your job title and your phone number and your manager attribute, and you can look at mine. Microsoft could have created the user profile synchronization service by leveraging the fact that every account can already read every other's account's information, except for the security-sensitive information like passwords. So SharePoint could have said, let's just go read all the attributes every 15 minutes, compare it to what the previous state was, see what's changed, and put that into our user profile database. They could have done that without any delegation, and it would have been brutally overloading on the domain, because it would have had to look at every account, every attribute, sort of compare it to what it was before, and bring it in. But it wouldn't have required delegation. What Microsoft did instead is it thought about Active Directory and said, you know what? Active Directory domain controllers, when a property is changed, they log that change. It's almost like a Facebook news feed. Oh, Dan's job title just updated, before it sends it off to its peer domain controllers. So the domain controllers have this little news feed of changes. And so what this replicating directory permissions change does is it gives the user sync account the ability to read that news feed. So it doesn't have to scan everything. It just pulls the information from this little news feed. And that's all it's doing. It's a more efficient way of reading attributes that it already has the permission to read. It is a very big benefit for your domain in performance. So that's the way to describe it to your Active Directory team. If they have any problems with it, have them call me. I'll explain it to them. But it really is not a very big deal. And you can point them to documentation up on TechNet that talks about it as well. So that's that little account. Now, you're also, to improve performance on your SharePoint side, going to want to have what's called the the object cache accounts. There are two of them, super user, which is has a write permission, and super reader, which has read permission, so to speak. And what these two accounts do is often misunderstood. It's documented heavily in TechNet, but I'm going to try to describe it for you. And before I describe it, I'm going to mention that these are not the same as blob cache accounts. It has nothing to do with remote blob store. This is yet another kind of cache. Now, what this kind of cache is very useful for is when you have, and I'll give you an example, is when you have document libraries or lists with versions and drafts. So you know you can have a document library and versioning and drafts, versioning can be on, and you can have these drafts that only a subset of users can see. So your broad user base can only see major versions, your editors can see minor versions. So when a user comes to a document library, SharePoint has to figure out which documents to show them. So should I show them just the major versions, or should I also show them the minor versions, based on whether they have write permission to that list or library? Now, one way SharePoint could have done that is every time a user viewed a document library, it could go query SQL with that one user's account and say, what can this user see right now? But that would have been very performance intensive. So what SharePoint does instead is it has these two accounts that sort of represent a user who can read and a user who can write. And it uses those to go get the views of those document libraries and cache them so that when you come to the site, all it has to do is say, can you read or can you write? And then it gives you one of the lists without having to go and build the list for you each time you look at the library. So it improves the performance of SharePoint in situations like that. So hopefully that helps you understand what those accounts do. SharePoint can live without them, but it hurts your performance. So again, this is something that's easy to do. I highly recommend you create them. Once you've created them, you can then go give them the policies they need, which are read policy and write policy. Again, that's all. The details are documented in TechNet. It's one thing that if you understand what it is and what it does for you and how easy it is to set it up, spend 10 minutes doing it on your farm, and it will help performance. So there's lots of other accounts you need over time. If you're doing Office Web Apps, if you're doing Secure Store, the list of accounts goes on and on. Again, in the beginning of this deck, there were some details on that. I'll let you read those online. There's a couple of other accounts I recommend you consider establishing for your SharePoint farm that are either underdocumented or not documented at all. The first is what I call your automation account. In every implementation I create an account called something like SP_automation. And this is the account that I use to run scripted tasks that I create. Many of you will have gone to my automating governance session back on Tuesday. It's basically a service account that I use to run scheduled tasks and scripts with the right credentials. So this account needs to have the rights that to do whatever it is you're automating. And I automate a lot in my environment. So I basically make this account an Uber god. I give it PowerShell privileges, local administrators, privileges on each server in the farm, in the farm administrators group, in the site collection administrator of each site, and the user right to log on as a batch service, which is necessary if you're going to use it as a scheduled task. So this is an UberGod account that's basically my custom service account for my scripts, and that's what I recommend that organizations think about. I also highly recommend that you create an UberGod account for your human being administrators, and this is what I call the Uber administrator account, or SP_enterprise admin. Now, basically what this is this is a godlike account for those few times when least privilege is not possible or is really painful. And I've run into situations like this, I'm sure many of you have as well, where if you're going to do a patch or upgrade, the account you're logged on with has to have so much permission, including permissions on the SQL databases that you as a human being normally wouldn't have to have in order to run those updates and patches and perform things like delegation of PowerShell. So these occasions happen very rarely, but when they happen, you have to have the right permissions in SQL, and if you have a separate SQL team, it becomes royally painful to call them up every month and say, hey, can you give me permissions on the databases again so I can make these changes, and then you fight about it, and eventually they do it so you can make the changes, and then they take you off and you do it again next month. And it becomes this constant, you know, battle, especially with separate teams. So if you create this account and you give it basically godlike privileges, it becomes a SQL administrator on the SQL instance or a DBO of all SharePoint databases, a local administrators group on all SharePoint servers and farm administrators group. It then is an UberGod account. It is a bridge between privilege on SharePoint and privilege on SQL. And when you need to do one of these things, you can use this quote-unquote generic account. Now, your SQL team will completely freak out that you're asking them for an account to be an administrator on SQL or to be a DBO of all the SharePoint databases. So what you can tell them is, first, this account isn't needed very often, so you can disable it until it's needed. It only has to be needed used at certain times. Let's disable it. You can also choose to give them ownership of the account. Let them set the password. Let them be responsible for giving you the password when you need it and then changing it when you're done. But it beats the heck out of having to change, having to change permissions on the databases, or gosh forbid, troubleshoot why Dan needs to do this right now and is getting permission denied errors. If you have one godlike account to get through those situations, it can really help. And just give your SQL team ownership of that account. They're generally going to be happy with that because it beats them getting calls at 3 a.m. to do things for you. So those are a couple of accounts that I find particularly useful. And again, there's more resources online. I've got links in the slides. And one of the things we talked about through that was the concept of application pools. And we kept the discussion really simple of having service accounts and web application accounts. Let's get into just a little bit more detail on application pool accounts and what's necessary. In SharePoint, you've got your web applications. And let's say we've got a team site web application called Collab. And those web applications, of course, have content databases where the content is actually stored. When a normal user goes to that website needs to be able to go get the content from SQL, and it needs a user account and a process to do that in. And so when you create a SharePoint web application, it creates an IIS site that's running in an application pool. And that application pool has a name. Let's call it SharePoint Web Apps. And that application pool is the process that's running on the machine that is receiving the inbound requests and going and getting data and rendering the content to the user. It's the process that if you went into Task Manager, you would see it running w3wp.exe. And that process, like all Windows processes, needs an account. And so you create an application pool identity. It's exactly the same as a service account that is used by that application pool. So let's create an application pool account called sp_webapps. Now, the creation of an application pool takes up overhead, which we'll get into more detail on in a moment. So you can't just have an infinite number of application pools. And one of the broad pieces of guidance is that you want to put new web applications in a shared application pool to reduce the overhead and the burden on your servers. So we're going to deploy another web application in our environment. I'll come back and talk about that later. We're going to deploy an intranet. Now, when we create a new web application, it's going to create a new IIS site and a new content database. And if we put it into the same application pool, we're reducing the burden on our server. And what happens when you create an application pool in SharePoint is the identity is given read permission, for example, or it's given permission, I should say, to the SharePoint content databases. So now this one identity is being used by both web applications as a single application pool to go and get content from both of those content databases on behalf of both of those web applications. So it's got the permission it needs called sp_data_access to go and get that data from the content database. Now, life is fine, everything's good, until we get another use case, which is an extranet. So we're thinking about deploying an extranet. We are thinking about how we're going to architect it. And we think, okay, we're going to have this extranet web application, obviously an IIS site associated with it. We're going to have a set of content for that extranet. We could, if we follow the guidance, put that into the shared application pool. And it would work perfectly well from a functionality perspective. But the challenge with that is then, if we have the extranet exposed a little bit more broadly to the public or to our partners, if someone hacks into the extranet and somehow compromises it, the process that is supporting that extranet is the application pool with the sp_webapps identity, which has access to all of the content in our environment. And so theoretically, someone could compromise the application pool and the identity and get access to the intranet and team site content, which would obviously be problematic from a security perspective. And so we have a relatively strong business driver to isolate security so that the extranet content is firewalled, so to speak, from the internal content conceptually. The way we do that is we create a new application pool for that extranet, create a new identity, and then that identity is given the right permissions to the extranet content database, has no permissions whatsoever to the intranet or collaboration content database, and we now have this security firewall. So that's the benefit of having multiple application pools, security-wise. There's also a benefit management-wise, because if the extranet hangs, we can reset that application pool without harming our internal application pool and vice versa. And there's a few other benefits performance-wise and management-wise to having separate application pools. So that's why we would want separate application pools, but again, the problem is they create overhead. They're a burden on the servers. You cannot have an infinite number of application pools. So the guidance is to have a shared application pool unless you have a real business driver for security isolation. Extranet is certainly one of them. Another very common one is to have the My Site host site collection in a separate web application, a separate application pool with a separate identity. And part of that is because in theory, every user is a site collection administrator of their My Site. In theory, then, they could install something in their site collection that causes performance problems, causes the My Site host to hang, and you don't want that to cause your intranet and your team sites to hang, so you isolate them. for performance management reasons. So that's a fairly common one to separate out into a separate application pool. So taking some of this together and sort of starting to build towards some guidance, in SharePoint, you've got several categories of application pools. You've got really highly privileged ones that run as SP underscore farm. Those are your topology service and your secure token service. You then have normal service applications like search and profile and metadata and BCS, and then you have your user-facing web applications. So you've got these three separate kind of classes of application pools. You've got a limited resource because you cannot have infinite numbers of application pools. And Microsoft's guidance is you should have support guidance is no more than 10 application pools per server. So if you had a one server farm, you could only have 10 application pools. That'd be a pretty hard limit. Now that is the supported limit. You can go beyond that, but Microsoft will potentially get to a best effort support model rather than a we'll fix it model. In addition, it really is dependent on the RAM of your server and the usage of your environment. So in most cases, what you'll really want on your server is far less than 10. I usually recommend customers in most of their, the way they build their servers, sort of 5, 6, 7, 8 application pools at the most. And that sounds like a real limit, and it would be if you had a single server farm. But if you have a multiple server farm, you now have a tier of web service servers. So those are really hosting your user-facing web applications. And in theory, you could use up to 10 application pools for that tier. And then you have your search server, and that can have its own application pool because it's dedicated. And you've got a couple of other service servers doing other service applications. You can use 10 on those. So as soon as you sort of go to multiple servers, you have, in practice, more application pools to work with. There are some details here about when and how you create these application pools. I'm going to skip that for the moment and get to the guidance, which is, again, based on the fact that you've got these several types of application pools and it's a limited resource. So I recommend that you have one application pool for all service applications. Whoops, wait a second. Hold on. And as a starting point, I should say, and a separate application pool for all web applications. If you have a driving business need for isolation, such as your extranet, your public-facing website, your My Sites, that might be worth having a separate application pool for. And whenever you do create a separate application pool, you might as well create a separate identity. Because even if you're creating a separate application pool for performance management reasons, you might as well get the benefit of the security management reason as well. Optimize your app pools, remembering that you can't have more than 10, and you really should be aiming for less than that. And as soon as you go to a distributed topology of multiple servers, you can, again, have many more web application pools to deal with. So while there are these limits and these considerations, I find that in most enterprises, if they align their architecture with their real business needs and their usage, they don't find that these limits are particularly painful because they're scaling to multiple servers before they run into real limits. So the slide has some links to more details on that. And I'll let you read those. And the final note I'm going to make about the Active Directory stuff is a couple of points about account management, starting with the fact that if you have multiple farms, you're going to have a challenge with your accounts. The beginning of this, or early on, we talked about the maybe 15 accounts you need to run SharePoint. If you have more than one farm, you actually are going to need its own set of accounts for each farm. Almost all of those accounts should be unique across farms. And so you want to think about your naming standard and how you're going to identify that this account is the SP Farm account for the production environment and this account is the SP Farm account for the test environment. You're going to need to have a naming convention that's ready to support that. And the reasons you're going to need a separate set of accounts for each farm, there's three, is first, least privilege. Chances are you're going to be doing things in your dev environment that might impact some of those accounts, and you don't want the changes you make down there to cause problems in your production environment. And you're going to give people ownership of the farm at the dev environment or the test environment that's different than who owns the production environment. Secondly, monitoring and auditing. If the Active Directory team is looking at an audit log and sees that SP underscore farm is being compromised or something's gone wrong with it, and you've used that same name across three farms, they're not going to necessarily know where the source of the problem is. But if you can see that it's SP underscore farm underscore dev underscore Dan, that's causing the problem, then we know it's that developer named Dan that's, we need to go think about. So it's better for monitoring and auditing. And most importantly, by having separate accounts for each farm, you're going to be able to take advantage of SharePoint's built-in automatic password management, which we'll talk about in just a moment. So there's very good reasons to have multiple accounts for all your farms. There are very few accounts that you can share. So for example, it may very well be you decide to share the crawl account for, you know, your maybe your test and your production environment. There might be some other scenarios that are nuanced where you can share, but basically most of them are going to need their own accounts. Now the challenge you find there is when you go to your Active Directory team and say, I need 15 accounts for my production farm and 15 accounts for my test farm and 15 accounts for my QA farm, they start again freaking out. I'll tell you exactly what to tell them when they freak out, and that is, oh, okay, forget it. Just give me one account and make it a domain administrator. That is the alternative. I mean, it's either least privilege or it's not, right? And if we're going to do least privilege, let's do 15 accounts. Let's do it right. Now, the reason they're freaking out is because of how hard it has been in the past to manage service accounts, and I'm going to show you that that pain has been solved, and because it means they have to sit in and click through and create all these user accounts, and I'm going to give you a script that you can hand to them that solves that problem. So let's jump back to our domain. Let's go back to our environment that was before we built SharePoint. Whoops. And we're going to run one last script. The script is, oops, if I can, create SharePoint accounts. Bam. Done. Let's refresh our domain. There's a new OU called service accounts, and there are all of our service accounts. Just that easy. So the way this script works, it's shown on the slide, but I'll show it to you in person since we're looking at it, is there is a comma-separated value, a CSV file of accounts. It looks like this. You can see the field names at the top and the data that I put in the file. So it's just a straight CSV file. I created it in Excel and saved it as a CSV. And then there's a PowerShell script. Again, heavily commented. The variables you need to change are at the top. Surprise, surprise, you don't want to be contoso.com. The OU that the accounts go in, and everything else is, and the name of, you know, where you've put the file, and that's it. And what it does is it uses one line of PowerShell, which is import CSV, which grabs the CSV file, and for each record in it, creates a new user, sets the password, and that's it. Oh, and actually, I think it does one other thing. It like enables the account. And enables the account. So one line of PowerShell, really, and a CSV file are automating all those accounts for us. So it actually is pretty darn easy, and that allows you to create the accounts in your dev environment, to make sure it's all working in your lab, and then bring it into production, to replicate it across disaster recovery environments and all that kind of good stuff. So that will solve one of the problems, which is how long it takes you to create that many accounts. It takes less than 10 seconds. And the next problem your Active Directory team will have is how hard it's been to manage passwords in those accounts in the past. So real briefly, I think we all kind of know the bottom line here. A service account, which is a domain user that's registered to be used as a service somewhere in our environment, the number one problem with that over time has been password changes. Because you would have to go to Active Directory and change the account in Active Directory, and then you would have to also go to the service itself and change the definition of the service so it knows what its username and new password is so that it can log on correctly when the machine or service restarts. And that has been incredibly painful over time. So SharePoint in 2010 introduced a feature called Managed Accounts. And I'm going to show it to you in a real quick nutshell. Many of you will know what it is, but if you don't, I want you to know what it is, and I want you to do it if you can. And what happens is first you create the accounts, and you saw me do that a moment ago. Then in your security page of Central Administration, you can configure managed accounts. And you register the account with SharePoint. And what this process does is you're telling SharePoint there's this account up in Active Directory, and here's what its current password is. Now, some of you, if you were looking at my script really closely, you might have noticed it set the same generic password on all the accounts. Here's why that's OK. We're going to go to SharePoint, and we're going to tell it, here's the account, and here's the current password. And from that moment forward, after we've registered that account, and that account is used by, say, a web application or a service application or a SharePoint service, the next time whenever we want to, we can go into that account and we can change the password now. And we can change the password in SharePoint, and SharePoint will then go to Active Directory, change the password. It knows what that account has been used for within SharePoint. It keeps track of that, so it updates the appropriate services and application pools and whatever is tied to that account. and it restarts the service, and it's all done. So you're only having to change the password in one place. Now you'll notice that you have the ability to specify the password that's in the middle there, current choice. You also can generate an automatic password. And what this does is SharePoint generates a random password that is compliant with your password policy, and it does it for you and doesn't tell you what that password is, which means now even your human administrators don't know the account passwords for privileged accounts. And that should make your Active Directory team and security officer smile big. That is a secure environment when the humans don't know the privileged account passwords. That is a good thing. And then if something breaks and you need to troubleshoot it, you just come in here and set a known password as part of your break fix, and then set it back to a random password later. So this already becomes more secure because it can create an automatic password, and it is more manageable because you only have to change the password in one place. And just as a note, this requires zero delegation in Active Directory. Any user who already knows their, if I know your password already, I can change your password. I don't need any delegation because I can use the change password option, which says what's the old password, what's the new password. What most of us think of with passwords is what the help desk does when a user forgets their password. That's a reset password. That requires delegation. This doesn't. So your Active Directory team doesn't even have to know you're really doing this. They just know that you've never asked them to change service account password, which is kind of cool. So anyway, you register the account and then you can change the password. Now even better, this is where you really want to go, you want to enable automatic password changes. So what this option does is it allows you to specify that based on a weekly or monthly schedule, let's say the second Sunday of every month or the 8th of every month, we're going to change the password at 3 a.m. for this account. And SharePoint will automatically do that. And there's a failover that you see as the little gray 2. There's a failover that says if the domain is going to force that account to change its password before the scheduled time, let's change it based on what the domain wants. So it'll either be based on the schedule or when the domain is forcing a change, whichever comes first. Super, super cool. And now hands off, it creates a random password that meets your domain password policies. So already, you have hands-off management of service accounts. Life is very, very, very good at that point. So having 15 accounts in 5 different farms is far less painful now. You create them, you register them, and you set automatic password, which is the piece that most organizations haven't done, even though it's there. So few customers have actually done that. It becomes really, really easy. So again, all of the details, if you need more, are in TechNet. I've talked through all the benefits and basics of it. The last note I want to make about these automatic password changes is, well, I've already said use them, configure out, and know the limitations. There are a very small subset of accounts that cannot be managed accounts. The crawler, and the crawler is one of them. So the default crawl account is an old school account where you have to change the password in Active Directory and then change it in the search service. The reason Microsoft did that with certain accounts is those accounts are typically used to access resources outside of SharePoint. So think if a crawler account is actually being used to index a Linux NAS server. That may have to have a password changed on that Linux NAS server that SharePoint wouldn't be able to talk to. And so SharePoint takes those accounts that reach outside the farm and makes you manage them the old way, which is wherever the account lives, you change the password, and then you change it in SharePoint. So it's not perfect yet. And what I do with my customers is we simply create PowerShell scripts, and we run them as scheduled tasks on approximately the same schedule as the SharePoint automatic managed accounts, and those become hands-free as well. We generate random passwords, we poke them in the two places, we restart the service. And so you can automate even the unautomated accounts, and you should. It's well worth half an hour of figuring out how to do it. Great question. So his question is, why not use the Active Directory Managed Service Accounts feature? So I actually, when I do a full class on this, I mention this. This is kind of a funny story, because many of us know Microsoft traditionally has been a company that when it spotted a problem, gave it to several different product teams and let them compete to come up with the best solution. So the problem here is how difficult it is to manage service accounts. Two different teams got the task. One, the SharePoint team got it and did it this way, and this is what you're going to want to do. The Active Directory team also got the problem and created this thing called Managed Service Accounts, which is addressing the same problem of managing passwords. You create this special type of account in Active Directory. It's basically a user with some extra properties. You you use it as a service account on a single machine. And then when the account needs to be changed, they can coordinate that password change. The problem with managed service accounts, first and foremost, is that the account is limited to a single machine. So you can't distribute those accounts across a multi-server environment like SQL or Exchange or SharePoint or anything like that. Also, the service itself has to know how to cooperate in the game. And some of the built-in standard Windows services can do that quite fine, but as soon as you get outside the Windows stack, you don't. So there are two answers to the same problem. Managed service accounts are a nice solution, but just not for SharePoint or Exchange or SQL or just about any other major server product. Each product has its own solution, and this is SharePoint. So thank you for asking that. I know that was a seed. I appreciate that. Good question. All right, talking about SQL. Chris McNulty is going to do a session at noon that is going to talk very heavily about SQL, so I'm only going to touch a few things that I know he's not going into quite so much detail or demonstration about. The first is the concept of an alias. Very simple concept, very important to use. The idea here is that when you create a SharePoint farm and web applications, you are pointing to a specific server and database name, and you're creating what's called a connection string inside of SharePoint. And so I'm pointing to, let's say, NYSQL05 farm configuration database. If you ever move that database to another server, or you upgrade the server and have a new name for that server, you've effectively got to go change the connection strings, which means going into your farm and finding everywhere that you've mentioned the server name and changing it and updating it, which is royally painful. So the concept of an alias is you create a fake name, and you say, today, this name refers to NYSQL05. And you use the fake name as you configure SharePoint. You use the alias. And then if and when you change your SQL environment, you upgrade SQL 2012, you create a cluster, when you do any of that kind of stuff, you change your domain, all you have to do is redefine the alias, one place. Because SharePoint is using the alias everywhere, and the alias is then being translated into the correct name. Now, from the tool we're going to use to do this is called cliconfig.exe. It is the SQL native client on our SharePoint servers. So let's jump in and look at that. Let's see, we're on our SharePoint server here. So it'll be cliconfig.exe. And it's when we go into that tool, we go to the alias tab. Let me zoom in so you can see it. So that's what we're talking about here. We're creating an alias. In this case, it's called SP SharePoint Production PROD SQL01. The real server name right now is SQL Server 001. And when I created my farm, I used SP Prod SQL 01. When I create my web applications and content databases and service application databases, I use the alias. Now, the way SharePoint works is this big stack of technologies, right? So SharePoint's kind of up at the top, and SharePoint needs to somehow connect to SQL. SharePoint doesn't actually talk directly to SQL. SharePoint talks through the native client. The native client is kind of like your workstation service talking to a server for a file share. So SQL is going through the SQL native client to get to the SQL server. And the SQL native client is where we're defining the alias. So when SharePoint says, oh, give me SPProd SQL01, it asks the client for that, and the client says, oh, I really know that's SPSQL01, and it goes and gets the right name. So it's being translated, so to speak, deep in the guts of the SQL native client. And when we redefine the server, when we change the server name, we simply change this alias and life is good. SharePoint doesn't need to be updated. So it gives us great flexibility and as we scale and deal with our SQL infrastructure. So that's what an alias is. It's that easy to create. Oh, and you do it on each SharePoint server in the farm. You technically do not have to do it on the SQL servers themselves, but a lot of documentation says, oh, you should, and you should do it in these three or four places. It doesn't hurt anything, but it's really SharePoint's SQL native client, 64-bit, that needs to have this information. If you add 32-bit components, you have to use some separate paths, but all of SharePoint can use this. So that's an alias. Now, don't do this by faking it out with a DNS CNAME record. A lot of organizations get the idea of we want to have an alias, but they do it in DNS, where they create a DNS entry that says the server called SQL Server 01 is really nysql05.contoso.com. That is by its the problem with that is that it makes managing Kerberos just a little bit more challenging, because Kerberos relies on getting a ticket for the specific server that the client is at service that the client is asking for. So if the client, SharePoint, is asking for SQL as Server 01, but it's being translated by DNS into a different name, the SharePoint server is going to go to the server with a ticket for SPSQL01, and it's just not going to work. Unless you just have to manage Kerberos a lot more crazily. It's a lot more service principle names that you have to create. So generally speaking, it's a bad idea to use CNAME records really anywhere in SharePoint. Your web application should be A records. Your SQL server should be an A record. If you do use CNAMEs, you're just going to have a lot more management to do. And the cost of managing CNAMEs is much greater than the cost, or is much less than the cost of managing Kerberos and SPNs. The one other note I'll make about aliases is consider the future of your environment from a scaling perspective. Because right now, you might have all your databases on one instance of SQL, but that might not be the same if you're expecting to grow. If you're growing SharePoint, it's very likely that you'll end up creating different instances of SQL for different parts of SharePoint. Common guidance would be that you put your content databases on one instance, you put search on another, and you put service application databases on a third in a really scaled environment. So you might think about creating, if you're going to be that kind of company in the future, create three aliases now. And today, point all three aliases to your one SQL server. But that then allows you to move your search database onto another instance and change only the alias for SPSQL search and not have to worry about going and redefining SharePoint again. So think ahead as far as your aliases go as well. All right. Database size, Chris is going to talk a lot about this, and given our time, I think I'm going to skip quite a bit through this. And there's not a whole lot of news there. I'm going to make one point about quotas. I made this in my Tuesday session. The two interesting things I see about, okay, we all understand what quotas are, setting storage limits on content, on site collections. The two things I find most interesting about this is, first, a lot of people think that you can create a quota for a site within a site collection. So if I've got my department's site collection and each department has its own website, then I might be able to create quotas there. You can't with out-of-box tools. So it is set at the site collection level, not the website level in SharePoint. The second and more interesting thing I see in customers is most customers don't actually have quotas at all. And if you don't have a quota, you end up with a default of infinite storage in your site collection, which means a user could theoretically drag and drop their C drive into their team site or into their my site, and is your SQL Server infrastructure really ready for that half terabyte of data that a user might accidentally drag in there? You need to have quotas, even if they're high ones. Have quotas that give you a firewall for stupid things happening in your environment. So even if you create a 200 gigabyte limit on site collections, or 100 gigabyte, which is sort of the out-of-box guidance from Microsoft, do something to firewall your server infrastructure from something stupid happening. Quotas are easy to create. They're easy to manage. You can create a single quota called Safety Net and set it to 100 gigs and put it to every single site collection. And then over time, when you really decide what your governance is around quotas, you can get more granular and apply other quotas. But do something, please, to protect your infrastructure. All right. There's a storage optimization section, a session right after this that Chris McNulty is going to be doing. He's going to be talking about remote blob store and shredded storage. Normally, I include those slides, but I took them out for this session. And then I got a special request for distributed cache. Who put it out on the Yammer network? Is he in here? Someone was specifically like, you really should do distributed cache. And I looked at the agenda, and I'm like, yeah, it's not being covered elsewhere. So I'm going to talk a little bit about distributed cache. And I've got to give a shout out to Spence Harbor, who double-checked my work on this. He's, you know, the guru of so many things, and he helped me with this, so I appreciate that. The distributed cache is a new function in capability component in SharePoint 2013. And it's important, first of all, to understand what the distributed cache does. It improves performance by keeping certain types of data in memory. It's a memory cache as opposed to a disk cache. And the two things that it's most commonly talked about, it does a lot of things, but the two most common and understandable things are, first, it caches tokens for users after they authenticate. In SharePoint 2010, if you had a two-server environment and a user, and they were load balanced, and a user was getting information from server one, and then whatever happened and it load balanced them over to server two didn't have that user's token and they got re-authenticated. Now, sometimes it was transparent if they were on IE and it was a trusted site, but it was happening. Sometimes they would get prompted. In SharePoint 2013, thanks to the distributed cache, if you have a two-server farm, the user authenticates to server one, that server puts it in the distributed cache, which is shared across the environment, and when the user gets bounced over to server two just grabs that token from the cache. The more performance interesting thing that the cache does is related to the out-of-box SharePoint social capabilities, things like tags and feed activity. Let's assume you're on a website, a team site, and you post something to the team site using the new sort of post capability. That post gets stored in the content database of that team site, and that happens all over your environment. Now, let's assume another user is going and looking at their newsfeed. So Dan opens up his newsfeed. Imagine how performance intensive it would be if when Dan opened his newsfeed, SharePoint had to query all the content in your environment to get the latest information. That would just bring the farm to its knees. So what Microsoft does is when a user is posting to their site, it gets put into the content database and gets put into this in-memory cache called the distributed cache. So the most recent activity is getting put into memory so that when a user pulls up their newsfeed, it's getting it from the distributed cache super fast, life's good. So those are two of the things that are really easily understood that the distributed cache does, and it plays some other similar roles of making information that's either complex to assemble or costly from a time perspective to query into an in-memory shared cache. It is a service that is run by default on all SharePoint servers. So every server that you install SharePoint on has a distributed cache service running by default that will, as it joins the farm, that will take 10% of the RAM of that server. Half of that RAM is actually used for cache, half is used for overhead because they're having to keep track of, you know, what's in each other's cache and things like that. 10% of RAM, so if you've got a 16 gigabyte server, 1.6 gigs is being used for distributed cache, 800 megs of that is actual memory cache, and it is literally a shared resource. So let's say you've got two 16 gig servers, each are using 800 megs for cache, you now have a 1.6 gig shared cache across your servers that they all can share. Now, there is some guidance to this, and I saw there was a question. I'm going to get questions after I finished the little story here. You should never have more than 16 gigs of cache, of distributed cache, on a server. That's sort of the hard limit that you want to avoid. So if you have a really big server, let's say you have a 200 gigabyte server, the 10% limit would be problematic because it would create 20 gig distributed cache, which is too big. That's not a hard one for most of us to avoid. All distributed cache hosts should have the same size cache. So this is important if you've got servers with different RAM configurations. You're going to want to manually set the cache size, which is done in PowerShell on those servers. You want to keep, and the most important thing about the distributed cache is that it responds quickly. So what you don't want is the stuff that's in the distributed cache to have contention issues when it's being requested out of memory or, gosh forbid, paged. You don't want that stuff happening. So you want to keep the distributed cache performing really well. And one way to do that is to keep it off your search servers, because your search servers are doing a lot in SharePoint 2013. If you don't know, first of all, there's all sorts of really cool stuff that 2013 does in search, but also they took some of the load off the SQL server and put it into the search tier of SharePoint. So it's a much more performance-intensive tier now, but it's making your SQL infrastructure perform better. So you want to keep the distributed cache off your search servers. If you have a farm with more than four servers, you should really consider having a dedicated distributed cache, maybe one or two servers, that are dedicated to that purpose in order to respond quickly. And if you're going to do a really large farm, you shouldn't have more than four servers acting as distributed cache. So remember, it's on by default on all servers. We're seeing some situations here where you might need to change the RAM, you might need to change whether it's on or not. And the way you do that is either during deployment or post-deployment, tweaking it. So there's a switch that you can use when you're joining a server to a farm with PowerShell that says don't provision the distributed cache service. There are also PowerShell commandlets that will deep unprovision the service and take it off of a server. And you want to unprovision it, not just stop it, because there are some ways that it works that you want to unprovision it from a server. From a management perspective, you've got these several servers who are sharing this RAM cache. It's a great service, it works really well, but you can imagine the problem if one of those servers just instantly went offline. If it went ungracefully offline, you've just lost half your cache of a two-server cache cluster, and all of a sudden there's holes in the data, and it's not giving you good quality data. So the way this is structured is if you do what's called a graceful shutdown of a server in a cache cluster, that server will transfer its information to other distributed cache servers in the cluster, and it just sort of works as it should. You can do graceful shutdowns in PowerShell, you can gracefully shut down in Windows, all that's fine. The real issues come if a server just it goes offline hard for whatever reason, then you're going to have some inaccuracies in your cache. When a server comes back online, there's timer jobs that help repopulate the cache, so that happens automatically. And one other note is what this really impacts from a practical perspective is if you're doing Windows updates, You don't want all of your distributed cache servers restarting at the same time. You want to do rolling updates, rolling patches, so that you're not having to rely on the timer job to rebuild the entire distributed cache for you. There's tons and tons of documentation of this on this on TechNet. There's some great resources on blogs out there. We'll certainly be collecting some of these at IT Unity, but I highly recommend, especially if you're going to have a farm where performance is important, where you're going to have a slightly larger than normal farm, or if you're really curious about the distributed cache service, please check out Spence's webcast on April 1st. He actually told me on the way up here, it's like April Fool's Day, it was not a coincidence that I timed the distributed cache talk that day. So do check that talk out. All right. A couple of last tips. Let me pick which tip to close with here, since our grab bag is now out of time. I'm going to show one non-technical thing that gets asked quite regularly, and that is about navigation. Common problem, and those of you who are in my Olympics talk heard this, but that wasn't a normal SharePoint conference talk. Common problem in SharePoint is, how do I provide universal navigation in my portal so that wherever users are, they can get everywhere else? SharePoint out of the box doesn't do that very well. It never has, and I'm guessing it never will, particularly given what we just saw with Oslo and the Office Graph. We're now looking at a personalized, search-driven, social-driven navigation rather than traditional navigation. So out of the box, you can only create easy navigation within a single site collection. You create a subsite, it adds the navigation by default. As soon as you have more than one site collection, more than one web app, more than one farm, things are breaking down. And so Microsoft created managed metadata-based navigation, but that itself has problems because basically you cannot create a single authoritative source of navigation that gets consumed by all site collections. You can use managed navigation, but the way you have to manage it over time is not easy. It's clunky. So a lot of organizations have turned to custom navigation, where they build a custom navigation solution that they expose through their branding and all their sites. Or there might be third-party navigation solutions. And honestly, in 10 years of working with SharePoint, I've never really had organizations come up to me and say, hey, we found this great third-party solution. This is what we use. And it's always seemed odd to me, because it's an obvious moneymaker for a developer to do a good navigation service. So I really honestly can't recommend one. The other approach that I do recommend is just say no. I personally believe that the concept that many of us approach navigation with is completely outdated, where no matter where you are, you should be able to get everywhere else. There's two main problems with that. First, our environments are very big and complex now, and that would make navigation extremely clunky for users. The more important reason is because users don't care anymore. Users now, the way they think, is there's always a home screen. They carry around these phones, and when you're in your calendar app, there's no link from calendar to the Twitter app. You click the button, you go back to your home screen, and you click the Twitter app. You're always jumping back home and then jumping into the app, into the work context that you're using. So users behave that way now. They get it. And what I want to show you is the navigation we built for the Sochi Olympics to give you an idea of what this means in SharePoint. The idea is we've got our home page. You'll notice it's very clean. It really is focused on navigation. So when we sign in, we see the home page. We can then go into our department, and we jump down to our team site. When we're in our team site, notice the global navigation is no longer there. We're in a context. The only navigation is what we need as engineers. If we now want to go and like look at the conference room calendar for the whole company, there's no link to that. We simply click the link of the icon in the upper left corner. And that's what users expect from websites. When you click the icon in the upper left corner, you go back to not the homepage of the site collection, but to the homepage of the entire internet. That's one branding change. And then from the homepage of the internet, we can open up the resources menu, jump down to the calendar. And then we click the icon in the upper left, and that takes us back to the homepage. So that solves the navigation problem. You just don't try to do it. You have one place where you manage navigation, which is the home screen. And everywhere else is just you drop down, you come back. You drop down, you come back. And honestly, having done user testing with this stuff, this is the way users expect it to work these days. They get it. You don't even have to train them. The only thing you have to do is change your branding so that the site icon in the upper left, instead of going to the site collection homepage, goes to your intranet homepage. So that's the only change you have to make. So with that then, we're out of time for our grab bag. What I will say is, first of all, mahalo. Thank you guys for coming. Secondly, don't forget, if you want to win, you can register, tweet, or email me. And third, please keep this conversation going. I will have all the slides in the deck from my entire grab bag from every session I do, so you'll see what's in there. If you've got questions on it, feel free to ask. We'll be documenting all these stuff at IT Unity. Have a wonderful session. Oh, and scripts. The scripts will be at the first URL here. tiny.cc, danholm spc14. It is case sensitive for tiny.cc. I will upload those Active Directory scripts later on today. Have a wonderful afternoon. Thank you so much for coming to SPC 14. Thank you.